the rest of the show will be English. Okay. We're still in source 16. Okay, let me just sort of summarize what with Moshe Feinstein. Everlasting, we keep summarizing all the time. Yes, there was a shear. I'm terribly sorry. Torah is politically indifferent. Anyway. Okay, let's go very briefly. But Moshe Feinstein is of the opinion that separation between men and women when they're dealing with large groups of men and women, that's an issue we still haven't defined yet, where Moshe Feinstein requires it. We'll do that a little bit later. I don't want to do it right now. But let me just tell you that Moshe Feinstein holds that if for one or two women, you don't need a kids. And that's why, for instance, Jerry walks in to close the windows. It's at a dinner that Moshe Feinstein mentioned that a woman used to come into the next section and say, Gadish, or we get in what we talk about. We mentioned in passing that the murder of possibly a woman may be getting out the old. There's no, if all the men are on Marazzi and they're not on me. And the postman, Moshe says that there's no problem because after all, it's only one woman. Okay, so Moshe Feinstein holds that this is a mass concept of Moshe Feinstein. His preferred view holds that it's biblically obligated. And in a second view, he holds it's biblically obligated only to make the Mikdash. And outside the synagogue, it's only a custom. That's the second view, although he doesn't. He mentions that in passing, but he doesn't like that. Okay. Then we learn that Moshe Feinstein is the opinion that the reason for the separation, the Beit HaMikdash, which was extended, was because the need, even though separation seemed to have been the first attempt, just to keep them separated, but the Chazal saw that if there was an easy possibility of physical contact and easy talking between the men and the women, that wasn't enough, and therefore you needed either the woman should be on a different level in a balcony, or that the woman, the mechitza, the height of mechitza to prevent physical contact and talking. This is Rav Moshe's analysis. This is based only on his analysis, on his logic. And then he says, therefore the mechitza has come up to the arm level, because that would prevent physical contact and easy conversation. And he says that's 18 tfachim, although he says, I'm willing to be lenient, the Rashbam seems to apply it 17 tfachim, not 18 tfachim. And then we try to boil it down to numbers. Boiling it down to numbers, Rav Moshe Feinstein says, 5.5 feet, but I'm willing to go down to 5 feet. And in one place, Rav Moshe even said 58 inches, okay, which is but that's about how high he was. So the magic number in most of these things is 60 inches. That's the number that's thrown around when you want to know how Bechal, how the Moshe Shita in the Chitza is 60 inches. Okay. 60 inches. As far as the material is concerned, the Moshe says as far as the laws of the Chitza are concerned, it could be anything. It could be see-through, it could be glass. Because the problem of Mechitza is not visual contact, the men, women, men seeing the women. It's physical contact, that's of course. And there's a problem with men staring at women. So that's a problem all the time. That's not in shul, it's not prevented. I mean, the women, men are allowed to look at women. It's a forbidden to stare, leer at women. And then he says that's a problem all over the time, all over. That's not a problem just in the difference. Deal with at the moment from Rav Moshe Feinstein is the question of what happens if they raise the level of the women's section. Now this happened a great deal. I grew up in that, where for the men's side, the mechitza was really quite high. The mechitza was approximately, I think, if I remember correctly, the mechitza was about 6 feet tall on the men's side. On the woman's side, it was only about 4 feet tall, because the women were raised, and you could see over, look, it's over, and it was certainly not, it was much lower than the shoulders. So essentially, that the woman could see when sitting down, essentially, it was that high.
And the
women were on the side. Women were on the side. This is my recollection. Now, I was a little kid, so this might have been Rabbi Singer Shul on Avenue. Oh, what? I'm sure the same thing. I mean, the shul that my cousin Shale Dobbins in, that's built that way. That's like that. Yeah, the women were raised up and the chitza was lower on the woman's side. Alright, so Rav Moshe Feinstein. judge then deals with that question. Okay? Now, what do you think the Moshe Benz is doing?
That it'll be fine because the separation is, there's still no problem of contact, physical contact.
Okay. Well, let me phrase it this way. That the differential in height has to be such that it makes physical contact difficult. The Moshe function is not, look, you need, let's put it this way. It certainly has to, from the woman's side, has to be at least 3 feet. Because from Moshe Feinstein, everybody agrees that if you want to separate the men and women into two areas, the main, it's got to be at least 3 feet high, right? Unless it's in a balcony, which is already, if it's raised, then there's no problem as well. But Moshe Feinstein will now begin haggling with what heights will prevent easy communion physical contact. So let's look inside. On source number 16, because of the pressure of the Balabatim on the rabbis, yesh bate knesset shidbiru et gitzvat ezvat nashim le'erch foot. That is, it's 4 feet on the women's side, 5 feet on the men's side. Foot v'yoter. Ve'ein minichin agbir the mechitzah, but they won't allow the rabbi to raise the mechitzah to come to them. Ve'zer lo tov lani yudati, that's not proper in my humble estimation. Kisholchot ha'nashim, ve'zer lo tov lani yudati, he says, I don't mind this. My objection is not a tzniut consideration. My objection is a machitza consideration. Mishum she'efshar b'kal b'koma v'anashim nuluchim ma'akneh. He says, that would be if the women were all 6 feet tall. I mean, we're going by the average woman. He said, the average woman, up to the shoulders is 5 feet. He said, but as though the average woman were 7 feet tall, he says, then I'd raise the mechitza. He says, that's what you've done. You just made the women not a foot and a half, 2 feet taller. In loshi yosifu ala mechitza chatzi foot. He says, if you make the floor 1 foot higher, you got to make the mechitza a half a foot higher. What's the logic? Because it's an extra half a foot on the woman's side and an extra foot, half a foot, on the men's side, so that's a different extra differential of a foot. Follow that? He wants the mechitza to be on the men's side. Shiyem mitzad ha'nashim go by 66 inches. Shehem chamisha foot v'chetzi. Mitzad amidat ha'nashim mundalad inches. Shehem alba foot v'chetzi. So that way, there will be, the women will be raised, and he says it will be much more difficult for the men to reach up. He's trying to make it more difficult for the men to touch the woman.
You mentioned the voice in half first.
He's assuming that they started off with the mechitza being 5 feet, okay? Which is the right height, the height that he says. But they now raise the woman's, they raise the floor 1 foot, so now the women are 4 feet, essentially.
But that is mentioning of
kalut rosh
and conversation implies that the problem is not...
Yeah, because on the men's side, the mechitz is up to here, and the women are standing over there. He says that's make it difficult for contact, and it makes it difficult for conversation. You're going to have to share. Okay. She said, yiksha lehem, because that will make it difficult for the women to have the kalut rosh. I'm not saying it's usher to leave it the way it is. Isa Bahu, Akim Loyad Bia Mechitza Yotel Mea Shishim Inches, Shem Chamisha Foot, Ak Shem Dati Mechem Isa. So he says, I'm not happy about it, because from the men's side it is 5 feet. But he says, it's not usher, but I'm not happy. And why should we do that? Essentially, you know, Moshe's saying it's not usher. He's not happy because he thinks it's hitting around his major goal, which was to prevent the man from coming from using physical contact with anti-Semitism. This is a classic example of what's called aimed after humming Yochai. You come and ask the Rav Shiloh, they'll say, it's not us, but I'm not happy. Because he feels it's against the whole spirit of it. Now, the individual rabbi will then, in different communities, that was the difference between having a shul being staying Orthodox and becoming conservative, or having Gulami and considering not wanting to be conservative. Each rabbi has to make those particular decisions. And in fact, he says, at the end of the tshuva, he says, I know that this community, the vast majority are yeshiva guys. They're supposedly more committed to halacha. Says they shouldn't go there. But it's a regular Balabatashi community. I can't say it's us here, but I'm not happy. Do the best you can. And then yes, there are other tshuvas, by the way, with all sorts of variations on the theme, but at the general drift. All right. Now, let us turn to the... Yes? Extreme right, you'll see, what you love to do in response to talking about the Rabbana Nehemi and Nidah. Okay, Rabosha is the one who holds the right of. Most other folks can hold that it's either the Rabbana as an extension from the Beit HaMikdash. They hold the Mechitza. They hold the Mechitza was Yira driven. The biblical obligation of Yira is only in the Beit HaMikdash. And rabbinically, it's in the Rabbana. So they're more going to be leaning on different aspects of Moshe was. The issue that really got the community against Moshe was his position on artificial insemination. Moshe had permitted and afforded couples that did not have children. They permitted, and the problem was from the husband, or an incompatibility with the husband and wife. They permitted, Rav Moshe Feinstein permitted artificial insemination from a non-Jew, which was a very extreme position. He said artificial insemination from a non-Jew solves a lot of problems because there's no parentage, there's no father. This is a kid with a biological father, but he only has a mother, doesn't have a father. In which case, there's no problem with your relatives. There's no suffering. The Haredi community lived in about it. They would call Rav Moshe night. Rav Moshe at that point, he used to answer their phones. All right. Now, let us now go in time to pick the last page, page 24. And we're going to see one example of the contrary position. What was Rav Moshe's position? Rav Moshe's position of the purpose of the Mechitza, the very last site, so 24. What was the purpose of the Mechitza to prevent physical contact? Now we're going to see a responsa written in 1873 by Rav Yehuda Lichtenstein. And you have to understand, let me just tell you about this period. Influx of reform in the 1800s. Anyway, so in the 1800s, the reform movement is beginning to come in. They're beginning to make changes in the synagogue. Changes like choirs and organs and mechitzas and all sorts of the liturgy changes. Depends how fast these changes occur. And one of it's having a wreaking havoc all over Europe. In each community, there was their own response, formal response. In the Hungarian community, the counter battle was led by the Chatham Sofer, and Chatham Sofer, at which point coined the phrase Kadash Asur Torah, in the speech of which is a play of words. Kadash is the new wheat, which is Asur, to eat until the 16th of Nisan, and he said, Kadash, anything that's new, which would be the Torah. That was essentially, it was a reactionary stance. Essentially, it was a position which many possible hold to this day. There's a tshuva came out from Rafael Blum, which I read just recently, who lives in Muncie, represents the Hungarian community, where he says that since the time of the Chatham Sofer, which is around the 1840s, says public policy is to be machmir in all public. Because we don't know if it's in the lead and we can't have the leniencies. Now that was a direct turnabout to where halacha wasn't in the maintain a position, the Geshemsha Asul, Lahatir et Asulka, Asul, the Asul et Amuka. Just as it's forbidden to matter that which is Asul, it's equally forbidden to Asul that which is matter. And here the Chatham Sofer comes along, and he's saying, no, public policy, we're not going to, for public policy reasons, whenever there's a doubt in the issue, we're going to be matter. Public policy is not. They felt they were fighting for their life. And in a very real sense, they were. Others, more in the Yeti community, more in the Litvisha community, they felt, said, look, depending on the situation, we sometimes have to give in a little bit, we're allowed to give in, and we have to hold our stance where we have to hold our stance. Maybe being too machmir is going to have the exact opposite effect. And this expresses itself in the early 1900s of fundamental machloket between Rav Kook and the Badats about Kitniot and about Shemin Kitniot, the one of the major battles. You can see the strains coming down from the 1840s straight down to the early 1900s, and it expresses itself in a variety of two trends in some. In 1865, there was a conference called the Conference of Mechadovich. A very, very major conference. I think 70 or 80 rabbis, mostly Hungarian, who there were 11 points, I think, that they were asked to sign, including the fact that a rabbi, there should not be male choirs, there should not be any prayer in the vernacular, that the rabbi shouldn't give the drushim, that it went on a whole, and I'm hiding the mechitza. All sorts of issues that come up, some of them halachic issues, many of them merely like Rav can't give a drushin in Hungarian. He's got to give it in the Lashon HaKodesh, which is Yiddish. You're awake. Okay, they got to give it in Lashon HaKodesh, which is Yiddish, and they can't change the normative situation. There are several poskim, like a Zriel Hill designer, and the Maram Shit, who said, we refuse to sign this. Because these points A, B, C, D, are not halachic issues. You can't go around saying things are asr when they're not asr. That's contrary to halacha. You want to say we don't think it's proper. We don't want to say it's migdal milta. Migdal milta means we as a community feel that it's not good for the Jews. But none of them have a right to do so, provided that they say the truth that it's migdal milta. Yeah, like you said, we went to the tshuva of that woman saying kaddish. Most of them say, we don't think it's good for the Jews. We don't think it's a good idea. And then you discuss that before, and you reevaluate every generation whether it is good for the Jews, but it isn't good for the Jews. And the modern generation, most of them say, we feel that it's counterproductive not to allow women to say, Kaddish. We saw this discussion.
What does it mean
with the Tov Kaddish? Where is it then?
Michalovce?
Yeah. There's no such thing. They never pronounced it.
Yeah.
Michalovce or something. I don't know. It looked to me like it was some.
You know what? You have seen it
before. Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe
Michal Svalbard. No, it's Michal something. It's a very famous, maybe not famous town, but a very famous meeting. And the vast majority of the Gedolim who came to that meeting, including the Rabbi Anna Street, the Bishop of the Aruch, and a lot of other sign this edict, forbidding the change of the size, the height of the mechitza, and all sorts of things. So this is the response written shortly after that, in 1873, where somebody, a student is asking him about the height of the mechitza. So let's read this. You ask me to be very so, if it is permitted to enter a synagogue where the partition dividing the women's section from the men is so gossamer thin, right, a very thin material, that the men can see the women. That is, if one is not of the defiant transgressors before, but wishes to submit to the verdict of the Bedin, okay? What says one, is this mutter or not? So you see already that in 1873 they're already thin mechitzas, even mechitzas. I do not know what there is to question here. It has already been clearly stated that it's forbidden to make the partition in such a way that the men can regard the women. Because the problem of mechitza is to prevent visual contact. And if the partition has already been so made, one should not enter there. That was one of the edicts of Michalovce, that you cannot enter a synagogue where there is this type of mechitza. This applies all the more strongly in your instance, for originally the division was thick and well made, and the people changed it with the intention of thus joining the violators and innovators. Moreover, even if there is not a single woman in the synagogue, it is forbidden to enter and pray there. For on account of this willful violation, it has become desecrated and is no longer a sanctuary. It is by the very fact that it has this see-through mechitza, it's lost its kedusha. It's no longer a mikdash, not a sanctuary. Let me just point that to you. In the 1950s, the Agudas Yisrael had a petition put out, which was signed by many leading poskim, including Rav Huttner and Rav Huttner and Rav Moshe Feinstein, saying that forbidding any Jew from entering or having affairs in a conservative synagogue. And everybody, you know, was really very much up in arms. Historically, this was merely a reenactment of all the aspects of Michalovce. You don't enter, you can't go in. One of those that didn't sign was on the salvation. Since I find your words so appealing, I will answer insofar as my poor hand is able. Now you are stirred by the question, why were curtains not put up in the festivity of the waters for libation in the temple so the men could not gaze at the women? He says there was no curtains in the Gemara in Sukkah, which talks about the separation, says the women were in the balcony and men were below. So if this problem is visual contact, why weren't there curtains put up? He asks. The answer seems to me to lie in Maimonides' comment to the Mishnah of Sukkah. And Maimonides indeed says, a great amendment that is of great value, because the people used to prepare a location for the men and another for the women, and the place for the women was above the one for the men, in order that the men should not gaze at the women. Okay? So we actually saw this, the remotion that the Rambam seems to indicate the prohibition was one of looking at the women. Okay? Now, remember some of the Moshe Feinstein said that is if they can get easy physical contact, that will cause the men to start leering at the women. That is the cause of lightheadedness. It's the ability for physical contact which will incite the men to riot. Okay? It will cause the men to begin thinking about the women and cause the men to stare at the women. But the major problem, he says, is the possibility for easy conversation and physical contact. If we know now, but that's not the way Rabbi Hillel Lichtenstein wants to go. He says, if we know his language carefully, we see that he could have simply said the place of the woman was above, in order that the men, etc., should not stare at the woman. But he's wise to say the place for the women was above the one for the men. It therefore seems to me that Maimonides means just this. It was arranged for the men to sit precisely underneath the balconies, but not beyond them. For if the latter, the men could have still stared upward. See what he's doing? He says that the way he had once explained the Rambam is that there was the balcony and the women were at that, and the men were in the yuk underneath the women, so the women, men couldn't see the women. Okay, now when we learned this, we saw that the Moshe Feinstein defeats this on two grounds. One ground is that first I can do this thing. Second of all, what about the men in the middle? And dancing and everything. So of the men were here. Lots, tens of men, 10, 20, 30 men dancing in the middle. They could see women. They could see the women. Just the women could see them. He therefore is last from the bottom. He therefore is intentionally specific to intimate that the locations of the men was only the space underneath the balconies. Hence, there was no need for a partition. Okay, so that's essentially. Essentially, he says the major problem. So we've got a little bit. He's representing the whole line. I'm telling you, he's representing the whole line of Hungarian skin. The purpose of the visual contact. And even the women are in the balcony. The men can see them without a curtain. The women can see the men. It's irrelevant. You have to have a curtain. That means that it is relevant, but you have to have a curtain. Everybody follow that?
It's also that a European customer. You know that in France, in the main street, the big bourgeois, in the Rue de la Victoire, which is absolutely not a good one. Dublin is, but the people are. There is a seat for the women upstairs.
The seat for the women upstairs, but doesn't mean there's a curtain. If you imagine go to the big mess of the door, right, the women, you can see them.
So, there's no curtain.
There's no curtain. Right? And that's because of the motion. Okay? Now, turn back to source number 19. What I'd like now to present is the position of Rabbi Soloveitchik. Okay, source number 19. We read now responsum of Rabbi Soloveitchik. Now you have to understand, remember when I was growing up as a kid, and I remember hearing from my father that there were a lot of rabbis from Jews from Logical College, Smucker from YU, were taking traditional shtetls. That's what they were doing. These were shtetls in which the men and women sat separately, and they didn't have a mechitza, but they sat separately. And generally these positions paid a lot more money than traditional rabbinate, which traces its history back to Joshua, Moses, and Sinai, and thus be ready to fight for an undiluted halacha, which is often not in the vogue, or to deteriorate into a so-called modern rabbinic group of undefined quality and of confused ideology, vague in its attitudes and undecided as to its choice. He writes very little. In particular, I wish to call the attention of the conference to the mechitza. I continue to receive reports from laymen from all parts of the country accusing many rabbis of displaying indecisiveness and even cowardice in this matter. They charge them with laxity and indifference, even in cases when the traditionally minded individuals are willing to organize in defense of the principle of segregation. You understand, rabbis were threatened to lose their jobs. And they were all about the willing to support them, and many of the rabbis didn't have the strength to fight because their parents had depended on them. And it was not easy initially. I have the feeling that a well-coordinated, aggressive effort on our part may stop, if not reverse, even the trend of Christianization of the synagogue. Okay, here is where our salvation comes out very powerful. He's now made, taking out of mechitza, right? The biblical problem. Not the mechitza, but removing the mechitza is a biblical problem because he views it as Christianization. If essentially the move to get an experience. That's the chukotayim. Okay. As soon as he uses the word Christianization, anybody has any halakhic training, here's the word of chukotayim. Because you can't follow them because of idolatry. For Jews, Christianity is idolatry. However, many of our colleagues choose the derech sara ve'amuka, the easy way, which leads them to doom and disaster. Reiterate the statement I have made on numerous occasions, now please watch this wording, both in writing and orally, that a synagogue with a mixed seating arrangement, okay? Mixed seating doesn't mean separate seating without the pizza. Mixed seating means men and women sitting alongside each other. Mixed. Forfeits its sanctity and its halachic status as a mikdash mata sanctuary literature, and is unfit for prayer and avodah shebaleh, the service of the heart. With full cognizance of the implications of such a halachic decision, I would advise every Orthodox Jew to forego tefillah b'tzibur, group prayer, even on Rosh Yom Kippur, rather than enter a synagogue with mixed pews, notwithstanding the fact that an officiating rabbi happens to be a graduate of a great and venerable yeshiva. No rabbi, however great is in scholarship and moral integrity, has the authority to endorse the advisory. Explain this basic deviation. Any rabbi or scholar who attempts to sanction the desecrated synagogue ipso facto casts a doubt on his own moral right to function as a teacher or a spiritual leader in the traditional sense of the word. I understand what he's saying. He says, you as a rabbi allow mixed seating in your synagogue. You don't have the moral right to function as a teacher or a spiritual leader. We're going to revoke your sin. That's why the fire will fight. No pretext, excuse. And by the way, there are many discussions in the RCA in this period, whether to allow rabbis with mixed views as members in the RCA. No pretext, excuse, ad hoc formula, missionary complex, or unfounded, you say, it's key roof, right? I'll have mixed views and I'll be key roof. Salvation. No pretext, excuse, ad hoc formula, missionary complex, or unfounded fear of losing our foothold in the Jewish community can justify the acceptance of the Christianized synagogue as a bona fide Jewish religious institution. I know beforehand the reaction to my letter on the part of my apostles of religious modernism and utilitarianism. They will certainly say that since a great majority of the recently constructed synagogues have abandoned separate seating, we must not be out of step with the masses. This type of reasoning could well be employed in regard to other religious precepts, such as Shabbos or dietary laws. However, we must remember that an ethical or halachic principle decreed by God is not rendered void by the fact that the people refuse to abide by it. Now, notice what he's done here. He's intimating a writer over here that the separation is biblical. He says, what did he just say? He's going to work up to it. I don't know if I ever told you the story of the famous preacher, the Southern Baptist minister. He was a very, very successful in getting his message across. And they would ask him, why are you so successful? Really, you're such a fantastic pedagogue. He says, first I tells him what I'm going to tell him. And then I tells him what I tells him. And then I tells him what I told him. And I get to read that salvation properly, because that's, he's constructing the paragraph exactly that. First, he works you in intimating where he's going. He says, you can't set aside something that's biblical. Now he's got to prove to you that it's biblical, right? He says, however, we must remember that an ethical or halakhic principle decreed by God is not rendered void by the fact that the people refuse to abide by it. Its cogency and veracity are perennial and independent of compliance on the part of the multitudes. If the ethical norm, thou shalt not kill, if thou shalt not kill, has lost its validity in the days of extermination camps and gas chambers, okay? When millions of people were engaged in ruthless murder, but on the contrary, has been impregnated with deeper meaning and significance, and every halakhic maxim assumes greater importance in times of widespread disregard and unconcern. The greater the difficulty, the more biting the ridicule and sarcasm, and the more numerous the opponent, then the holier is the principle, and the more sacred is our duty to defend it. He's waving that flag. It is my opinion, the halachic dictum, the sha'at gzerat malchut, afilu mitzvah kala kegon, the shinuye akata demesana yirei ve'al yavor, which is the Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says that, okay, the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, all commandments if a man is asked to violate, right, we say, you tell them to violate. Because life is more important than the fulfillment of a mitzvah, with the exception of the big three, adultery, incest, and murder. Except for the big three, we say violate. However, there are two major exceptions. One major exception is if they insist that you violate in public. They say, cook a Shabbos, you cook a Shabbos. Go to city center and surrounded by the multitudes of people, I want you to cook a Shabbos. That's called the Esya. There's a minion. Can you account for this minion? And you got to. Second of all, the Gemara says that if it's Shah Kashma, if they're out to get Jews, okay, and they're out to get Jews to violate. Now this is the old-fashioned anti-Semitism, not the new-fashioned. The new-fashioned anti-Semitism, they don't care, you can violate all you want, they don't get you because you're a Jew. That's the new-fashioned anti-Semitism introduced by the Nazis. And you can convert to Christianity, which is from Jewish, and they'll kill you. That's new. That's Nazi, new anti-Semitism. That's racial anti-Semitism. The old-fashioned anti-Semitism was all they wanted you to stop functioning as a Jew. Acting as a Jew. You would violate, and now here they're out to get something like the Greeks and like the Christians and like the business. They're out to get you because you're functioning as a Jew. So they say, what should be Machal Shabbos? So if it's the Shat Shmad, where they decree Jews shouldn't do A, B, C, D, it says you have to let yourself violate. Of course, it's not a few of the Son. Even Jews have the custom of tying the shoes in a particular way. I mean, there's all sorts of questions about what this means. I'll give you an example. Jews wear kippot. And they tell you, take off your kippot. Okay. That could be an example of Arkansas and Asana, even a total custom. Right? Next, you take off your kippot. We don't want you to look like a Jew. The discussion goes from the rock and you take it off before they ask me. If I'm walking down the street and they say to me, take off that hat, take it off, and it's Shat Hashmad, then they're out to get Jews, then it's awesome. That's what it says. That's what it says in the parentheses. At the time of religious persecution through governmental decree, even for a minor custom, such as one involving changing a shoelace, the Goyim wore red shoelaces and Jews wore black shoelaces, and they say, let one suffer death sooner than transgress, requiring of us a heroic stand in time of adversity. Right? Applies not only to political and religious persecution. Now we're in the other one. Applies not only to political and religious persecution originated by some pagan ruler, but also to a situation in which a small number of God-fearing and Torah-loyal people is confronted with a hostile attitude on the part of the majority dominated by a false philosophy. This is a very extreme position. He says, if you're in position of a shul, you have a shul. And this, the community doctor is conservative and they want to take the reins out. Or must assume a militant stand against them. To make absolutely clear my position on this latent question, I would like to relate this incident. A young man moved into a suburb of Boston, where the only existing synagogue had men and women sitting together in mixed pews. He asked me what he should do on the high holidays, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Until then, on account of the mixed seating, he had not entered the synagogue. But the days of war, he was very reluctant to remain at home. I answered him that it were better for him to pray at home both Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and not cross the threshold of the synagogue. A few days later, he telephoned me again. He had met the man who was to sound the shofar in that synagogue, and this man had warned him that if he did not come to the synagogue, he simply would not hear the shofar at all. So the man would not sound the shofar again privately for his benefit. The young man practically implored me that I grant him permission to enter the edifice, at least for half an hour, that he might hear the shofar blast. Better not to hear the shofar than to enter a synagogue whose sanctity had been profaned. Now that's essentially what he says you stay home, don't hear shofar, don't come and don't hear kol nidre, don't do nidre, just stay home and don't hear shofar. My stringent position, you have to understand, this is coming from Soloveitchik, who's considered a big moderate. My stringent position against the mingling of men and women arise from several reasons. Okay, let's see what his reasons are. First of all, such mingling is forbidden according to halacha. In certain instances, biblical law prohibits praying in a synagogue where men and women are seated together. Such a locale has none of the sanctity of the synagogue. Any prayers offered there are worthless in the eyes of Jewish. He's saying that if you have mixed seating, you have bracha and not bracha. Not yotze. Secondly, the separation of the sexes in the synagogue derives historically from the sanctuary, where there were both a court of women and the court of Israelites. In its martyrs' history of 1,000 years, the people of Israel have never violated this sacred principle. Moreover, when primitive Christianity arose as a sect of the Holy Land and began to slowly introduce reforms, one of the innovations which the sect established at once in the externals of the synagogue practice was to have men and women sit together. In many instances, mixed seating was the unmistakable sign by which a Jew could recognize that he had found not a place of sanctity of Jews to pray, but rather a prayerhouse for a deviating sect. For in those times, the Christians had not yet formally differentiated themselves from traditional Jewry. As a secret sect, they endeavored to hide their identity only through certain definite signs could they be recognized. Okay? That is, essentially, he says, the early history, they doubted it. The people didn't say Tefillah. They said Shmoneh Esrei. We know that one of the ways that it was meant to ferret out the Christians was by introducing the bracha, V'lamal Shinim HaMisigva. Okay? The original text was V'lamal Shinim, but was V'laminim, the meaning of Christians. And any chazan refused to say the bracha, it was immediately recognized as a Christian. Himself. It would seem to me that our remembrance of history alone should keep us from imitating today the practice of primitive Christianity almost 900 years ago. Thirdly, the entire concept of family pews is in contradiction to the Jewish spirit of prayer. Okay? Prayer means communion with the master. Now he's writing the theology. The first two arguments were halakhic arguments. One was that it's forbidden that it's forbidden to men and women to daven mixed. Second of all, the problem of the chukotem lo teleko. Thirdly, now this is a theological consideration. Says davening means we confronting our maker. Thirdly, the entire concept of family pews is in contradiction to the Jewish spirit of prayer. Prayer means communion with the master of the world, and therefore withdrawal from all and everything. It's you and me, God. Right? You and me, God. Nothing, nobody else is around. During prayer, man must feel alone, removed, isolated. He must then regard the Creator as an only friend for whom alone we can hope for support and consolation. And as it says in Psalms, behold, as the eyes of the servants look unto the hand of the master, as the eyes of the maiden unto the hand of her mistress, summarize, look unto the Lord our God until he be gracious unto us. That's what Shmuel Esrei tells us to be about. Prior to Shmuel Esrei, you and you with God. He's not talking about Kriya Shema. Kriya Shema is a statement of faith. Essentially, Kriya Shema is a statement of faith. This communion with God is Shmuel Esrei. We talked about the woman covering her hair, right? We saw the Ramans, and the Raman would hold the obligation to cover one's hair. And we talked about the size of her mayor, or woman, is Shmuel Esrei. Because in Shmuel Esrei, you're in God's presence. You're standing there in front of the God making your requests. Clearly, the presence of women among men, or of men among women, which often evokes a certain frivolity in the group, either in spirit or in behavior, can contribute little to sanctification or the deepening of religious feeling. Nor can it help to instill that mood in which a man must be immersed when he would communicate with the Almighty. Out of the depths have I called thee, O Lord, says the psalmist. Such a state of being will not be realized amid family people. In my opinion, Orthodoxy must mobilize all its forces and wage an indefatigable battle against Christianization. I have no other name for of the synod. A process which is being accomplished by people who possess no sense of halacha and no historical philosophical concept of the nature of prayer, but they do have the arrogance to wreck principles and traditions which have become hallowed through blood and tears. And I do not believe this battle will be lost. In the mingled seating of men and women and men, I see no progressive idea which could appeal to the person of culture. The American Jew, though he is ignorant in matters of Jewish law, has a great amount of common sense and a certain intellectual honesty. I am convinced that if the Jewish public were to be enlightened on this matter, it would react quite differently to this reprimand. It would understand that the separation of men and women implies not disrespect or contempt for women, as the representatives of the half-reformed camp would interpret. What's half-reformed? Conservative. On the contrary, it is based, because they understand, why do I sell the Hebrew? Because the word conservative means to preserve. He didn't want reform means to change, right? Actually, they chose that name because it was the concern relative to reform. The relatives of the Orthodox see people for their salvation before it's after reform. On the contrary, it is based on the Jewish sense of modesty, a sense identical with the attitude of reverence for deity, a sense which Judaism of Abraham and Sarah had shown toward women as the mother and builder of the people of Israel. When they, the angels, said unto him, where is Sarah thy wife? Abraham simply replied, behold, in the tent. In practical terms, Orthodoxy has three tasks. One, to conduct the program of education through the oral and the written word. Two, to morally support those individual laymen or rabbis who often give themselves in self-sacrifice to a battle for the sanctity of the synagogue. Mostly in action for reform, will begin with the obstinacy of one despot in the brotherhood or sister. Were the observant Jews well organized, and if they but had a more aggressive attitude, reform could in many instances be averted. Three, Orthodox organizations should undertake to build synagogues in the suburbs and new communities where Jews are settled. What's happening is the conservatives are building it. Because no, we Jews got to move out there too. If the various synagogues organizations were concentrating and organizing new synagogues in Jewish communities in America, they would accomplish much. We have not yet lost the battle, but we have not yet begun to fight. We have but abandoned the synagogues much as the French abandoned Paris before the Germans fired the very first shot. Even today, however, we can yet defend our position if we will but have the determination. We must have the will to do battle, for the synagogue is the center of Jewish communal life in this country. No movement or organization is as strong as the synagogue. When we lose a house of prayer, we lose a strategic position. A right battle for principles is always a worthy and honorable endeavor. Gird thy sword upon thy thigh, prosper thy God on behalf of the truth. Okay. Guys, come on! Soloveitchik will now go into. He has, again, he keeps waffling. He doesn't give, tell you what's the Sefer Deraita. Where does it come from? What's the source? Okay, 1956, 2 years later. First, let me reiterate in precise and unequivocal terms my position with regard to the seating arrangement of the house of worship. The separation of the sexes in the synagogue is a basic tenet in our faith. It dates back to the very dawn of our religious halakhic community and constitutes a Pentateuch injunction, which can never be abandoned by any legislative act on the part of a rabbinic or lay body, regardless of its numeric strength or social prominence. What was decreed by God can never be undone by human hand. In my opinion, mingling of the sexes is by far a more flagrant violation of a great principle than installing an organ or praying with bare heads. He says that, because we already know, we all discussed it, that praying with a bare head, part of the Vilna Gaon, is only midat chasidut. But other people's objects maybe is more strict. But at least Soloveitchik is having separate seating is more important than the issue of having an organ in shul, which is only also the Rabbanon, playing an organ in Shabbat, for instance. And he says playing very bare head is a problem of the Rebbe Hasidic part of the world. Yes, using the etc. Well, your facial expressions were... I know, look, in this Michalavcha, the claim that you will be in just having your own sort of this. Soloveitchik doesn't seem to be as bothered by that. He's just trying to, you know, he says, there are the Jews that will fight to the death not to have an organ in the shul. He says, but doesn't seem to bother him. Okay. Unfortunately, while every traditionally minded Jew understands that the latter practices tend to strip a synagogue of its Jewish quality, Judaic quality, and are tantamount to an attempt to Christianize a ritual, many well-meaning and sincere Jews are being misled with respect to mixed seating arrangements. There are some Jews not saying these things, it's supporting Mishnah organs. This organ is also Christian, and davening with bare head is also Christian. But he says, in many ways, halachically, it's worse to have mixed seating. I wish to state that I do not know of any Orthodox rabbi or Talmid scholar of high repute who would dare to say that mixed seating is in consonance with our law. Neither the Orthodox Rabbinate of America, consisting of three major organizations, which was the Rabbinical Council of America, the Adonai Rabbanim, and the Igor Rabbanim, which is the Babish. Nor the chief rabbin of Great Britain and its dominions, nor the rabbinate of the Holy Land, would ever even vaguely suggest that such a practice is permissible. The requirement for separation is a lachmi solamukri and axiomatic, historically so typical of the synagogue in contradistinction to the church since antiquity, and philosophically so expressive of our religious experience, using back to the three reasons he gave in the previous piece, that whoever dares to question this institution either is uninformed or consciously distorts religious theology. Now he's coming down to the picture. As to whether or not halacha also requires segregation, I wish to say that there is certainly a requirement for the erection of a partition, and the synagogue which fails to erect one is guilty of violating a very sacred tradition. Sounds to me like he holds the mechitza is a mina. It's not clear, not completely clear to me. This is a very sacred tradition. However, let's see. However, there is a basic difference between this wrong and that of the complete mingling of the sexes. For as I indicated above, separation has its origin in the Bible itself, whereas the requirement of mechitza must be attributed to rabbinic organs. Okay, so he's saying now that mechitza is rabbinic. He says it beferish. Okay, so when he said before sacred tradition, he says now he's saying it's rabbinic. The biblical passage, essentially what he's going to say, okay, the biblical passage from the Talmud derives the introduction against mixed pews and also the Pentateuchic injunction, let him see no seemly thing in the לא יראה, זה היא בזווית, לא יראה בך ערבת דבר. Deal with separation only. Okay? He says, what was the source? He says, what's the whole source of the pizza to the Beit HaMikdash? The Hesped by Zachariah. The Hesped only talks about separation. Also, the verse, V'lo yireh b'cha ervat davar, says, if you look at the Yavid Shemoni, what? Yavid Shemoni, what? Yeah. The Yavid Shemoni on this verse, we actually saw this. Okay, let's look at the first page. Just turn back so you'll see what it's referring to. That's not the first page. It's the first page, second side. Source number 9. First page, second side, this is what the celebration is referring to. Okay, source number 9, line 3. On this verse, V'lo yireh b'cha ervat davar, V'lo yireh, third line, you see it? V'lo ya'amod bein ha'nashim, V'yitpale'el mepnei dat ha'nashim, El yekadesh machaneo chamisha amod b'chol tzad.
Is it 10?
That's 9. So, the Yalkut Shimoni says that when you set up your camp for prayer, you should not be mixed with women. There should be a separation between you and women. The Yalkut Shimoni says here 5 amot, other posts say the women are on the 5th amot, there should be 4 amot. And it is a discussion of how much separation you actually need. However, there's gotta be separation. Let's go back. That's what he's referring to. He learns that this is biblical. We're in source number 21 again. Okay? That's what he says. Look what he says. He says, just underneath the underline, the biblical passage from which the Talmud derives the interdiction against mixed pews, Zechariah 12:12 in the Gemara Sukkah, and also the Pentateuch injunction, let him see no unseemly thing in thee, deal with separation only. There is no mention, however, of segregation. There's no mention of mechitza in the proposal. The latter has been introduced in accordance with the old maxim, va'asu siyag v'tovah, make a fence around the law, as a safety measure in order to prevent the mingling of the sexes. The biblical itself, however, only requires separation. Although complete separation is important since we have no authority to make even a rabbinic institution, yet it should not be treated on the par with the principle of separation. While the latter determines the very essence and the sanctity of the synagogue, the former, if violated, does not place the congregation in the class of the Reformed temple. What he's saying is that if the kid in the previous head had asked her Soloveitchik, it says separate seating. Okay, it has separate seating. And I want to go here, he says, yeah, it'll be all right. If a rabbi would come to him and say, I got a shtum in the separate seating, the Soloveitchik says, look, I'm not happy with it, I'll make sure you got it. I'll let you with the rabbi there if it has separate seating. On the condition, you try to get it on the pizza. But
welcome.
Work on it. But if it has mixed views, it's a little bit you will not allow them to dominate. You can't dominate. He says that is a violation of biblical commandments, and he says therefore it loses the sanctity of the synagogue. In conclusion, let me say that it is completely irrelevant to our problem. 50 or 5% of the membership of the Rabbinical Council of America occupy pulpits and synagogues with improper seating arrangements. He's still at 56 fighting the battle in the RCA. The violation of a religious or ethical principle does not affect its validity and potency, even though a large segment of the community is engaged in doing so. A transcendental tenet is binding regardless of its unpopularity with the multitudes. Was the commandment against murder declared null and void while the Nazi boys were practicing genocide? Question mark? Exclamation mark? All right, now we've seen what Soloveitchik holds. Let's see what he holds. He holds that mechitza, that the obligation to have separation, now we can understand, that's the outer separation, now look at the Gemara. But Soloveitchik said that originally the men were on the outside and the women were on the inside. Why were they separated? Nothing. be separated. You have to have them separated. In prayer and in ritual, you have to have them separated. And then they brought the woman and the men on the inside, but they were still loving each other. So they brought the women on the inside, and the men on the inside, and the woman on the outside. Still separated. And then they saw that that didn't work, so they put the women above and the men below. That is effectively putting them in the chitza from the woman and the women. That, he says, that's only drug burn. Okay.
Look.
Segregation is men and women being separated, is the right yeah, but a partition. Okay. No, he clearly holds that the, when he says, what does segregation mean? Segregation means a partition.
Yeah.
Partition, yes. Now, how high is the segregation? Do I have rabbi at Harvard Hill in 1969? There was a, when we came in there, there was a machitza that was 50 inches high. And there were a lot of balabatim who complained the machitza was too low. Because they were the Moshe Feinstein required 60 inches. I came in there, 60 inches, and I talked to Rabbi Ben Zion, who was a conservative rabbi, but very sensitive considerations, a very, very good Jew. And he said to me, look, I have a chitza based on the Pesach of Soloveitchik. It's been this way for years. Give him a call. I called up Rabbi Soloveitchik. Petrified. It's my first conversation with Soloveitchik. Raised in the winding circle. Called him up, and Soloveitchik asks him to tell himself, and I asked him to tell the story. Soloveitchik says, it has to be 50 inches. 50 inches. I then said to him, does it make a difference what the material is? He says, it makes no difference. 50 inches. I said, 50 inches? 50 inches. The time I succeeded to hang up, and then for the rest of my life, I was upset. But I never asked him why. What is your... No, what was the mahala? What was it, Yom 17? Now if you're asking me, I would say that there's a whole different shita in how the high the mechitza has to be. Okay? He holds that there has to be a substantial separation. He obviously holds that 10 fucking is not enough, you need more. My feeling is, and I did a simple calculation, that Rav Soloveitchik holds that it has to be 17 tefachim, where each tefach is approximately 3 inches. Here's a tefach, and it's all, a tefach is a fist, 4 fingers. There's all question, all sorts of shiurim, how much the tefach has to be. And if you measure the tefach of being around 2.94 inches, or 7.47 centimeters, it comes up to being 50 inches. Rabbi Antelman, when he was at YU, he said the Rav told him it could even be 40 inches. Okay, Rabbi Antelman wrote an article in the YU commentator. He reported is the history of Mechitza and his conversation with Soloveitchik on the subject, at which time he writes that Rabbi told him maybe it should be 50 inches, is maybe 48. Okay, actually, you know, now that I come to remember it. When I came in at the Harvard Hill, the Mechitza was 48 inches high. Now I remember, the Mechitza was 48 inches high. So I raised another 2 inches. But I remember that it was 48 inches. Now Rabbi Antelman told me that the Rav said 48, 50 inches that you saw last week. So that was based on the recital of the Rav. It really was. I mean, it was based on the recital of the Rav.
Why?
So,
a lot of men
have
Hassan
and Hassan. That's a very good question. Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin maintains that the mechitza has to be, okay, let me put this in, the mechitza that we had in Harvard Hill was curtain on top. The curtain on top is a solid. solid curtain, it was a heavier curtain, and then there was a curtain on top, which was a mesh see-through curtain. Okay. The hanging and blew the wind, and that it wasn't the standard of the pizza. The hanging is the uterus, the grandson, is a beginning that a mechitza has to be 3 feet of regular pizza. Separate the two domains, and there it has to be solid, like the walls of a sukkah have to be solid, not to blow too much in the wind and the light. And the top part is merely to prevent the physical contact. And as he holds, there's two parts to the mechitza. The first 3 feet is to separate the domains. The top 2 feet is to prevent the kalud rosh, the contact, that's his analysis. Okay, he's adding this, there are three responses back and forth between him and some rabbis of the Rav of the Kibbutz of the T, which he knew the rabbi in Beit Shan, or the one of the Shivim in Beit Shan, that had this battle back and forth from the Klim of Soloveitchik. When I asked about Soloveitchik, does anyone know the structure of the place? 5 feet. That's all he was concerned about. He said, ask him about structure, ask him about material, and he said, 5 feet. He didn't care. What was it? As long as it was a physical barrier of the body. Yes. He said, I'm sorry, 50 inches, I thought, 4 feet to the floor.
He said that he had to make the pizza higher by 2 inches. Can the bottom be 2 inches without anything?
Can the bottom be
8 inch
curtain,
raise it 2 inches.
Oh, so that the bottom is. Okay. I would say that in fact that's really what it was. You just
held
6 inches. So they held 6 inches, I agree. They discussed that. You know, Henkin seems to feel that it has to be with the 3 feet talking with the ground. Soloveitchik just had to do it to prevent. I don't think the people have a problem touching it. I don't think Soloveitchik would have objected. It was like a few inches off the ground. You know, while Rav Henkin, if it was more than 3, it was more than. That's not coffee. 3 tefachim. It has to be connected to the ground. Less than 3 tefachim, which is approximately a foot. Off the ground, if it's less than a foot off the ground, then it's considered like it's connected to the ground. I think Rav Henkin actually talks about that. He says the rules of that, the bottom 3 feet have to be very much like the rules of the wall of the sukkah. There are a lot of postings, these are all nuances on the theme of the. Alright, now let me just tell you what the times are. We're going to finish with 2 more responses. One is by Rev. Regensburg and one by Rev. Oaks about and we also have to start moving into the construction of the pieces of weddings and then that's pretty much what we're talking about. You can go home now.